Hey everyone, this is Jay at Project Unity, and today I've got an interview that has been in the works for a little while now. There were delays to this, primarily due to the New York Times scenario that I got myself wrapped up in, and since then we've been looking to set aside some time for me and this gentleman to have a bit of a chat. And so today I'm speaking with one of the UK's leading defence analysts, former aviation editor for the world's premier military affairs journal, Jane Defence Weekly. He's a corporate storyteller with a background in business consulting and journalism. It's my pleasure to welcome Nick Cook onto the channel. Nick, how are you, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, Jay. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm really glad we've got a chance to jump into this now. And the first thing I kind of wanted to start off with was just saying thank you once again for sending me a copy of your fantastic book, The Hunt for Zero Point. This is a book that a lot of people in the UFO community are familiar with, and it's a title that I'd come across a few times prior to us getting in contact. Now that I've read it, I must say it really does a good job of putting the reader in your position as you navigate through the kind of like inevitable rabbit holes that I think a lot of us who research this topic are familiar with. So I'd like to kick this off by just kind of asking what the initial inspiration was for writing The Hunt for Zero Point. Was it something that you knew you were going to do whilst you were in the middle of your investigations, or was it a decision you came to after the fact?
No, I when I set out to research what became The Hunt for Zero Point, I had no idea I was researching a book. I was doing my day job. My day job was the aerospace editor of Jane's Defence Weekly. As you said in your intro, it was, still is, I think, the premier defence magazine worldwide. It had a worldwide brief. And I suddenly realized that I was in this incredibly sort of privileged position where I was granted interviews, or I could arrange interviews with just about any defence individual on the planet, to begin with, obviously with an exception possibly in the Soviet Union. But even that, actually, in the end, I was able to, because the wall fell down in the middle of the research behind it, so I was even able to get over there. And I just thought, it was at a time when black programs were just beginning to emerge into the light. And back in the 1980s, late 1980s, there were rumors of stealth aircraft. There were rumors about the B-2 and the F-117 stealth fighter. People said they were seeing things around a place that at that time was known as Groom Lake, but
Right.
became known as Area 51. And so, as the editor, as the aerospace editor of the magazine, this was something that I had to cover. There was also, I worked with and had within my sort of portfolio of colleagues an amazing investigator and writer called Bill Sweetman. Bill and I worked occasionally together on various stories about stealth and so forth. So, sort of in this atmosphere of black programs being exposed to the light, that I came to ask myself a question, which is, okay, Nick, you've got this editor's position at a really good defense journal that gives you access pretty much anywhere. What's the world's biggest secret in the defense realm that you can think of? And the one that came to me really was it was that somewhere a some form of propulsion system, some form of propulsion or energy source might have been developed that had then been buried and hidden away.
Right.
But everything else happened as it happens in the book, which was, it was sort of weird synchronicities happened. Like, I got this article landed on my desk, which
Yeah.
said basically the anti-gravity engines had been
Yeah,
devised and
the
built in
G
the
engines are coming or
1960s.
something like that,
Yeah,
right?
all of that. So suddenly I was sort of then on this kind of on this pathway, and it resulted 10 years later in the publication of a book.
Right. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned synchronicities, because I thought that that was something that was kind of spattered throughout the whole book, was this feeling of like each turn there was another coincidence or something that would just kind of come your way that would lead you further down that path, and the initial paper clipping, that news clipping that arrived on your desk, just seems like such a fortuitous thing that led you down this route. So I don't know how you sometimes look at things in life in that way. I sometimes think that there's less coincidence and more of something else going on, but it seemed like you were taking down a pretty direct route to find out the kind of things you were going into. And, you know, you cover a lot of ground in this book, from T. Townsend Brown and the apparent kind of anti-gravity cover-up in America from the late 1950s onwards, all the way over to high-ranking members of the SS and the Nazi German involvement in electrogravitic studies during the Second World War. I'm wondering if your opinions on any of this have shifted at all since the time you wrote the book, or do you still feel the same way about how some of our history has played out?
Well, I'll come to that in just a second, but just to say, because you were talking about synchronicity.
Yes.
If I had known then what I know now, or what I believe I know now, because actually this then leads into the second part of your question, which is, have my opinions changed? The biggest mistake that I've made probably I think the biggest mistake anyone could make when investigating this realm is to lock themselves into one set of parameters. So the hunt for zero point is just that. It's a hunt. It's me going off in search of, to begin with, as you say, it was a search for a new propulsion source, a new energy source, anti-gravity. But actually, what became more interesting to me was the journey itself.
Right.
The journey was utterly fascinating. And in a sense, it was my sort of, it will sound a bit strange, but it was my sort of love letter to an industry that I'd really enjoyed working in. Admittedly, this was a very dark side to it. This was the flip side to it. When I entered the business, you know, for me, it was a business that I'd always wanted to go into. It was, you know, the Farnborough Air Show and aircraft flying over crowds and wowing them. And, you know, I'd been brought up in that sort of tradition.
Right.
So to discover relatively late in the day that there was this antithesis, there was this flip side to the business, that there was a classified world in which any number of programs or projects could have been buried, was a fascinating thing for me to go off and investigate. And it told me just as much about me. And we're going back now more than 20 years ago, because I began researching it in 1990 and I finished it researching in 2000, and the book came out in 2002. So it's already now, you know, almost 20 years old. But it was about the journey. And yes, I have utterly changed my views probably a million times since the book actually came out. I mean,
well, that's a healthy thing.
I hope so. You know, it, like I say, I think it behoves no one to be locked into a single steady state position, because chances are, in this, when you look at this phenomenon, and I think ultimately, I hope in the conversation that you and I will touch on something that I know interests us both, which is consciousness.
Absolutely.
When you get into that realm, there are no borders. It shifts and changes and moves all the time, which is why I think one needs to move with it.
Absolutely. You know, to quickly finalize on the hunt for zero point, and we'll move into some other topics. You know, with this book, you provided a really clear path for readers to follow, you know, to help them connect the dots as it progresses with your own investigation when it came to this book. And I just think that it's a really worthwhile read. For those who haven't, you know, had time to check it out, I'd really recommend reading The Hunt for Zero Point. It's an old one now, but if you haven't read it like me, I came into this subject only a few years ago, and there's so many different books and so many different things to look into. It gets hard to do it all, but I would recommend for people looking into the history of this to have a look at this investigation, because it's worthwhile. But Nick, you've got another book out. You mentioned before we jumped on record that it's a fiction book. It's not the same as Hunt for Zero Point, which is a historical account. But this is more about the idea, I believe it delves into the idea of consciousness, or the mind as a new warfighting domain, so to speak. Is that correct?
Yeah, it had its origins in an idea.
And this is called The Grid, by the way. Sorry, I didn't mention that. This is Nick Cook's brand new book called The Grid. And so there you go. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I've written fiction as well as nonfiction, and it's always interesting to me where an idea for a book begins. You know, obviously it's with a spark, and the spark for me had been this. Again, it was a question, which is, could you write a thriller, a mainstream thriller, about the proof of the existence of God? And that was sort of what I wanted to write about originally. And then I sat down and started to plot it out. And of course, you know, these things evolve and morph. And so by the time I actually sat down to write it, it became to be about consciousness.
Right.
And then whether there were, that would be of interest as a thing to the defense and intelligence community. And I don't want to say too much more about the book because it will spoil it. But that is the backdrop to it. It's the substrate, and it allowed me to explore the consciousness realm and then to really get interested in that. And, you know, I know you've articulated how you got into the field, and you know, I wish I'd got into it in my 20s.
Right.
But I came
to the
whole subject very late, and you know, it is endlessly fascinating, as we both know.
It really is. So without revealing too much about the book content, I wanted to kind of just stay in this vein of consciousness and perhaps intelligence or defense apparatuses that are growing around this. And so what do you see the future of psychological or mind warfare to really be?
So I gave a talk at MIT at the beginning of the year about this. And in essence, it took the audience through an evolution that starts with psychological warfare operations, you know, which have been around since time immemorial.
Right, right.
Finding ways in which to use information to influence, you know, an enemy's behavior has, as I say, it's been around since forever. But if you sort of project, you know, where things are going and where we are and where we've just come from, you know, wherein we've got manipulation potentially on a very large scale through social media, what that can do to people's attitudes,
right,
what social media tells us and them and anyone who wants to hack into it about us, because, you know, I'm constantly being told that you click 10 times on a like button and, you know, they then know exactly what they know as much about you as your wife does.
Yeah, yeah,
you do that 100 times, they know more about you than you do.
Yeah.
And you know, whilst that might be a slight exaggeration, it probably isn't much. But where do you then take that? You know, where do you extrapolate that from? I think that what we have seen recently in the it's not just the UFO realm. I've also come from an area where I've been able to look into things like remote viewing.
Right, right.
And we ought to talk a little bit about that probably in a moment, because I've just co-written a book with the late great Ingo Swann.
Oh, brilliant!
Obviously, the sort of godfather of remote viewing.
Well, my introduction to pretty much like the UFO subject was actually trawling through CIA FOIA libraries, and I discovered the Monroe Institute, Stanford Research, and all of this. And so remote viewing was actually the first thing that I stepped into that led to the idea of consciousness, which, you know, expanded as I progressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I saw that talk that you'd given, Jay, and you know how you'd you've gone down that rabbit hole. And so I've also gone down that a ways too. And so coming from some of that discipline and some of that thinking, if you bolt that onto the whole data manipulation thing, the psychological warfare thing, I didn't think it would be a stretch. I told the MIT audience that in the not too distant future, you could, in a sense, manipulate reality itself. And surely, I mean, the one thing I do know about the black world mindset is that once you you get an idea, don't let your imagination constrain you, because your imagination can take you anywhere. All you need is the dollars to make it work. And, you know, that's when mind-bendingly, literally, awesome technology gets deployed. I mean, it happened with stealth, and it has happened with other, you know, directed energy weapons. And I believe that's where warfare has the capacity to go, unless somebody comes to their senses and goes,
right,
enough already. You know, this is crazy. We're playing with Pandora's box in a way that we really shouldn't be.
Well, I think another, and I agree with you that it's a Pandora's box, and I think another one is AI, and just kind of staying within the same thread of a kind of psycho-spatial warfare. Do you have any opinions on the integration of AI into the human system? I'm thinking now about initiatives like Elon Musk's Neuralink, which aims to merge AI computer learning with the human brain. You know, what's your opinion on what are we stepping into here with this introductory merging between AI and consciousness?
Well, I heard your, you know, I've listened to your very cogent, in my view, sort of breakdown on how you view reality and how we perceive reality. And to me, and I agree with you, reality is a very malleable thing. It is not the straightforward interaction between sort of, you know, the back of our eyes and the photons that bounce off something that I'm looking at that we all think it is, or physics thinks it is. One of the most interesting analogies I've come across about what reality is was has been given by a professor at UC Irvine, the University of California, Irvine, called Don Hoffman. I don't know if you've come across him.
No.
But his analogy is, reality is the graphical user interface of our computer screen, and we interact with the icons on the computer screen, and that is our experience of reality. But, of course, there is a depth to the interface which we never get to, or at least most of us don't get to play with. And that's the hardware and the software, the guts of the machine. But that is what reality is. We have evolved a sense of reality which is sufficient only to our survival, our survival needs. What we see is what we've evolved to be able to survive in this very malleable reality space. So, I you know, regrettably, I think it's entirely possible that that malleable space can be influenced. And when you've got AI thrown into the mix, it just means that this, you know, we're on a spectrum of reality.
Yeah.
Starts with, you know, the hard knock of my table here, but extends right the way through to something that is incredibly porous. And in that very porous domain to reality, some quite interesting phenomena can emerge. And, you know, I think we all know we've seen some of that phenomena emerge very powerfully in the past couple of years. I'm talking about, you know, the US Navy's own admission that it is encountering things, objects, you know, unidentified aerial phenomena that it is at a loss to explain. But I think those things, you know, they emerge on a portion of this spectrum that we've been talking about that we call reality.
Well, you know, I very well put, and I agree with you. One thing I wanted to say was that And I was actually, it's funny, I was talking about this with a friend of mine today, that we've gone through obviously different stages as humans, as we've developed through societies and civilizations, but we've got a tendency, especially in the West, to externalize everything around us through either, you know, technology, and there's not so much space for introspection, self-reflection, the kind of things that meditation and more actually Eastern traditions teach. And one thing that I kind of have a feeling we're doing is, you know, we've refused the inner world for a long time. We've refused the consciousness world for a long time. And we've almost rebelled against it by, you know, building these industries and creating technologies and doing everything that we can externally. And with that happening, this technocratic development, there hasn't been much of a philosophical or empathic or it seems to me that we're way beyond going back to being in small groups, small tribal groups in shamanic ways and kind of being one with nature in the way that we would understand it. But it also seems like that's almost a way that we have to be. There's like this necessity to go within now. And you're seeing this with the development of AI, consciousness integration, more studies into the mind, but we're externalizing it still via a technological modality. And what I mean by that is that we already have, I believe, the innate natural tools within us to go very deep down into consciousness and get information from that well of that force of information. And some physicists even say that the universe is made out of information. That's how they understand it. And so we as a technocratic society are developing technological assets wherein we can go within ourselves in some way when it's already a natural ability. And it just makes me wonder what our projection is for the next decade, two decades, three decades. You know, are we going to become basically like cyborgs in some way where we're just integrated into computers? And is that necessarily the right path to go? Or, you know, can it even be averted at this point?
Well, there's a load of really good stuff to unpick and unpack there. But the more we play around with nature, the more potentially nature fights back. I mean, that obviously is it's self-explanatory and very obvious in a sense, in that we see what we're seeing with climate change. But I think there's more to it than that as well. I mean, I'm a sort of great fan of Carl Jung. Yeah. And I think there is some sense in that when we deny our birthright, when we deny certain facets of ourselves, that to me, and this, I say this particularly having worked with on this Ingo Swann book, but also I knew Ingo Swann as well. He died in 2013, but we hung out a bit together. I nearly made a documentary on him, and now I've written this book with the blessing of his family, which is really his book, but it's sort of like his great lost treatise on consciousness.
Wow.
And it came out last month, so August. It's called Resurrecting the Mysterious. And, you know, anyone who's interested in this subject, I urge them to read it, because Ingo knew a thing or two about consciousness. But getting back to Carl Jung, the more we try and deny, I think, who we are, where we've come from, and that we are, you know, essentially spiritual beings, the more the I don't know what you want to call it, reality, I guess, and consciousness itself throws things back at us that says, you know, we're here, I'm here,
yeah,
this is here, and you need to be reminded of that. So, you know, if we fiddle around too much with ourselves on the AI front, is that going to lead to more phenomena, more reality bending stuff emerging?
Right.
Possibly. I mean, as you yourself say, you know, the really interesting exploration is the inward journey. And we've denied that at least for 250 years, you know, since the age of enlightenment and the age of reason.
Yeah.
And possibly longer, a great deal longer still. And look at the trouble we've got into, and look at some of the emerging signs in phenomena terms that I think are possibly reminding us that the world is infinitely more, or reality is infinitely more complex than any of us dare to imagine.
You know, I absolutely agree with that, and that's some. It's what you just said is quite quite similar to. Are you familiar with Terence McKenna?
I am, but I've not read any of him.
Well, he's an interesting guy. Obviously, did a lot of natural psychedelics throughout his time and was a bit of a Renaissance character in that sense. But he had some very interesting theories. But one of the things that he said about the UFO subject, and it's not something that I particularly subscribe to indefinitely as a definitive definition for the phenomenon, for all UFO sightings, etc. But he put forward the idea that, you know, this phenomenon could actually be in some way the collective overmind, the unconscious collective overmind of humanity stimulating itself through some form of, you know, visual or some sort of phenomena that is at that time unexplainable and requires further investigation and stimulates curiosity and stimulates innovation. And you know, that perhaps it's a symptom of behaviors happening on a global scale, and that this phenomena is, you know, no different to getting white spots or black spots in your eyes when you're feeling dizzy, but it's like a global phenomena that's representing itself. And, I don't know how much of that I subscribe to, but I do like the idea that there could be some form of almost unconscious to each individual, but the collective consciousness of humanity is actually trying to help itself by stimulating some form of event.
Well, I resonate with that completely. I mean, but if you'd asked me, you know, 5 years ago, maybe even a year ago, whether I'd be talking about all of this, I would have said, not only would I have said no, I wouldn't even have understood the question. and I'm not sure I understand it now. But yes, I absolutely agree with that. And it gets us into a very interesting realm, I think. Because, you know, when you look at, so backtrack a second, I was an aerospace editor. I deal in facts. I dealt nuts and bolts. I loved that job. It was fascinating. And it got me into some very interesting places, as we talked about at the beginning of all of this. But when it comes to UFOs, which, of course, I was always interested in, because they in a sense were a sort of outgrowth of those black programs, those stealth programs that I'd started to look at when I was at James Defense Weekly, and through the hunt for Zero Point, you'll know that, you know, part of that journey was to determine whether there was a, you know, a single point explanation for things in the sky that we see that we can't explain. And my answer to that journey was no. There is not a single point explanation to that. I wish there had been, because it would have made it very neat and simple, and I could have wrapped it up and gone home. But I think when it comes to UFOs, there is definitely, of course, there's a phenomenon there. I mean, the US Navy says there's a phenomenon there, for heaven's sake. But is it real or is it immaterial? Is it... If you picked up a brick and you threw a brick at a UFO and you hit it, would it go clang or would it go through it? Well, I think we all know that it's both. These things land, they make real traces, they leave real traces in the environment, they show up on radar screens. So on one level, yes, they're real. And again, I think we need to look at this on a spectrum. They're unquestionably craft. But there's another aspect to them as well, where they are, I think, immaterial. And I do think that they probably or possibly do come from this, as you call it, this unconscious collective overmind, or what Jung would have described as the collective unconscious. And I just read this very interesting book by Jeff Kripal, and it's called The Flip. And he talks, I think, about this same realm as the imaginal realm. Right. It is this quasi space, this point in reality or part of the spectrum of reality that we've been talking about, possibly behind the graphical user interface of Hoffman's reality machine, wherein things assume that real and unreal state. And I think that is an incredibly interesting realm to look at, because I think it tells us as much about us as it does about the phenomena that we study. And I think it will yield real clues, perhaps, to, you know, what we are dealing with. So, yeah, I've not read Terence McKenna, but I probably should.
Well, he's been, I haven't read much of his material, but he's been immortalized on YouTube. You know, there's a few people like that who did a lot of lectures back in the day that were recorded. And if you type in Terence McKenna on YouTube these days, you'll find video after video of him just doing lectures for hours on end and some fascinating topics. A brilliant guy. But you know, what you were just going over is actually something I wanted to get into. And because obviously, as you know, and I'm sure this is something you want to talk to me about, is I've had successful contact. At least I believe it's been through some form of successful consciousness communication that was accepted, and for whatever reason they decided to appear. But I have my own, you know, kind of thoughts on this, because I do believe that consciousness itself is the substrate upon which reality arises, in my opinion. And obviously the speed of light is the speed of light, but the speed of thought is instantaneous. And I think that the speed of thought is actually what these UFOs travel at and utilize. And so it's almost like you were saying, the imaginatory realm is the same realm in which these things travel and perhaps interface with and maybe are even formed from. And, you know, it could even be that these are completely physical beings just like us who have just managed to understand how to tap into the underlying force that is reality. And that force, in my opinion, is consciousness. So once they've managed to do this, they would be able to quite literally manifest things at will. They may even be able to take the form of a flying saucer and still just be a being. I know that that's a very outlandish way, but the thing is, once you get to this point of acknowledging that there is some form of conscious phenomena going on, it makes it hard to put a flag in the ground and say this is where it stops and, you know, nothing else can go on. My mind is quite open to the idea that there's a very strange explanation for the UFO subject. It's like Jacques Vallée. I don't know how much you've looked into Jacques Vallée, but he, you know, he completely...
I've met Jacques Vallée, which is...
Amazing. I wish I was you, Nick.
Yeah, he's a great character, and I admire him greatly.
Well, I just wanted to say that his model of the UFO phenomenon is again something that I do resonate with. And he said himself that he'd be very disappointed to find out that it was just extraterrestrials in spaceships. And so I resonate with that personally. But I, you know, one thing, because obviously you've been looking into consciousness and you have a history of the UFO subject. With this investigation that you've been doing at the moment, have you actually looked into the idea of contact, like a consciousness contact being a modality to do this?
Well, no, actually, that's one of the reasons I'm interested in talking to you.
Good.
Because it strikes me that when we talk about this very permeable, malleable, imaginal realm, that, you know, this is something to me that needs to be studied. It's a bit... cod perhaps, because of course it's all over History Channel, but you know, I watch Skinwalker Ranch, like,
oh yeah, yeah.
And you know, to me that's just the perfect epitome of the imaginal realm. Things happen that are paradoxical, that don't make sense. Very little of it makes sense, but it leaves real traces in the environment. I know you've endured some skin, well, I wouldn't say injury perhaps, but you know, some skin,
yeah, got some marks,
phenomena that you've shown on your videos. So these things leave real traces in the environment, but yet they are paradoxical. They don't make sense. So I am intensely interested in this realm. And I'd be very interested to talk to you about your own experiences, because, you know, I'm not saying that. And the thing about this realm is it's not imaginary. It's not that our imagination is making this up. But yet it is non-literal.
Yeah, that's a better way of putting it.
This speaks to me some shift in consciousness, some shift in reality, some shift in a state that we do not yet understand, but in which these phenomena appear. And quite possibly I would put many, if not all, of the phenomena that happened at Skinwalker in that bracket. So the question from me, if I may, to you, Jay, is do you think they can be studied? Is there the phenomena in this realm can be studied, and the realm, this non-literal realm, do you think it can be studied? Meaning?
That's a good question. I think yes, but it's not going to be the same conventional way that we've studied things in the past. I mean, I suppose that's a little bit self-evident, because you're looking at, and, you know, I'm a layman, I am not a scientist, but, you know, you're looking at quantum mechanics and quantum physics, and this is where we're going, this world of very strange, novel physics. And I think that we're probably going to have to develop different approaches to understand this. And, you know, for some people it's controversial, but I still see this as a forefront in the development of the expansion of consciousness, is you do have a somewhat of a psychedelic revolution happening right now, because you've got universities and institutions that are starting to look into things like psilocybin and dimethyltryptamine or DMT, and these compounds that allow people to expand their consciousness beyond just their normal waking perception. And they're looking at it intently, and there's actually, weirdly enough, Imperial College London is trying to map the DMT or the dimethyltryptamine. Are you aware of DMT? Have you heard of this? Yeah, okay. So Imperial College London, from the last I heard, they were actually trying to map the DMT space and bring back data by intravenously introducing this to someone, so that they could be on it for a lot longer and be in that space for a lot longer and bring back information. So there's very strange ways in which people are trying to understand this realm. And I think that's the only way that you can really understand something that's so abstract, is you have to have abstract approaches. And I think that one of the ways in which I think, if we're going to just stay in the realm of psychedelics, in which you can find data for this, and even transcendental meditation and things like that, deep meditation, but there are similarities that go, you know, from individual people all over the world having very similar experiences, going to the same places, meeting the same entities, or having that same kind of conversation with the same beings. And it does make you wonder if something like psychedelics is a gateway into another type of reality, another frequency of reality that we don't really understand fully. And that, you know, perhaps that's almost a cheat code to get to it, because there's a lot of people that will say meditation and other ways of quietening your mind and calming your awareness can get you to these states. But it seems like we're a very shamanic culture. I mean, it's not like we're against altered states of consciousness. You know, we're very proud of our caffeine and our alcohol and our cigarettes, and, you know, we have these things in our lives, but we demonize things that seem to take us into a new perspective of reality. And, you know, there's been so much fear around those types of compounds that they're only just starting to come back into the forefront and start to get rigorous study. But I think that that's one area in which we're looking in a very novel way at something that is indeed itself a novel phenomenon that we're trying to understand. So I think that it can be studied. And also, from a more technological aspect, you have things like the Sapphire Project, which is a new energy project, which is trying to, you know, create a completely exotic physics paradigm, essentially, through their energy of what they call bottling the stars. I think that was their term for it, which is they're creating a miniature sun in a laboratory environment. And so there are lots of ways in which we're kind of starting to break away from the status quo of physics, of science and consciousness. And I can't say for sure how we'll properly and adequately research it, because it's kind of like trying to quantify God or something, you know, or like you can't fully describe this stuff. You can't pack it up and go, right, here is a spreadsheet that has all of the information about consciousness on it. It's not going to be that type of thing, but I think it's going to require us as a humanity to step into a new way of understanding it, you know, and when we do that, we'll develop the tools in which we need to understand it fully.
Well, so that's interesting to me, because it seems to suggest that, and I agree with you. I mean, there are, even in that short burst of conversation there, I mean, you mentioned a number of modalities that are in essence subjective, but which yield an objective result in some way or form. The psychedelics is one wherein, you know, multiple different experiences can go into a psychedelic realm and potentially they can see some of the same things. So that to me is a subjective experience that delivers some objectivity, which is interesting to me. We've got a few others. In fact, I mean, I would submit in a sense that CE5, you know, is another form of that. It's another modality that is kind of subjective, but actually yields to an objective set of results. Shamanism, I think, probably is another too. So there are, it strikes me, a number of modalities that can be explored, which might open this realm up, which I think will be very interesting indeed. And I'd certainly like to talk to you more about CE5, because I was going to ask you, in fact, what do you think it is? What do you think you're experiencing when you have these experiences?
You know, if you'd asked me that maybe 6 months ago, I'd have probably a different answer than I have now. It shifts and changes because I'm not 100% sure. I think it would, you know, I think without sounding offensive to anyone else, I think it would be relatively naive to assume that we know what this thing is. I mean, for me, I've had a few different things come across my skies, but the most notable are four experiences with orange orbs of light, which were completely, there's no way to throw that away as a terrestrial explanation. The thing that I saw, that those things were completely not normal. And you know, for me, I just I've kind of blanked on what the beginning of that question was, and I really liked it. I've forgotten. Can you remind me?
Well, it was what your sense of what you were experiencing is.
Right, what it is. And so, you know, these things were beyond a sort of normal explanation, but I can't say what they were. I don't know what these things were. I've gone outside each time in a space of positivity, in trying to, you know, I'll meditate beforehand as much as I can, and I'll go out and I'll be in a very loving, peaceful, diplomatic state of mind. I think that that's really important, because I do actually believe in the law of attraction. I believe that what you perceive, what you believe, you then receive back to you, you know. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that will say, well, I've had negative, you know, I might be an abduction victim. I feel like I've been abducted by UFOs or something like that. And, you know, so there's a lot of negative aspects that people talk about with the phenomenon. And then they will attribute that to CE5 and say, well, with CE5, you shouldn't be doing this because, you know, cattle mutilations happen and abductions happen and all these types of things. But I personally feel that you are interacting with something different if you are actually resonating at that level. I mean, so someone that I am speaking with, I've been speaking with for some time, who claims to be in intelligence in the US, and, you know, we've had long conversations about consciousness. And one of the things that they brought up was that, because we were talking about Stephen Greer and CE5, and because obviously a lot of people know about CE5 through Stephen Greer, and I was saying to this guy, you know, I don't do this big puja ceremony, and I don't read Vedic Sanskrit, and I don't light the incense and do this big kind of thing about it. And he said, well, that's okay, but what you need to understand with, you know, Stephen Greer is that he's setting up a very specific channel to interact with a very specific type of force, and that if you are broadcasting essentially on all bandwidths out into the universe, you can't maybe expect the response to always be something you want. And so he's doing it very specifically to make a very specific type of contact. And so he, you know, he said that to me, and it did make me think about it, because, you know, I go outside and I think positive thoughts, and I honestly believe that whatever's going to come and interact with me is going to do it because they want to try and help me awaken to a bigger understanding of consciousness, of how we interact with, you know, other beings in this universe. I do want to believe that, but I can't ultimately say that is the case. The only thing that makes me think that it probably is the case, that this is in some way something that wants to assist, is that whenever I've had a successful contact, it has been when I've been thinking in a mindset that I would like to always think in, that I don't always think in, you know, the higher mindset, the good mindset, the pure soul mindset that we'd all love to think and be and live all the time, but we're humans and we all make mistakes and we mess up and we have bad thoughts. So whenever I'm in a really clear, genuinely pure, loving sense of self and awareness, they pop up, I'll get flashes in the sky and, you know, repeated flashes in one spot. And it seems like they're trying to signal in some way, yes, you're on the right path. Keep thinking that thought, keep thinking that way. And so for me, it's been positive. Now, I do have, you know, these three little dots on my arm that are in the shape of a triangle. And this happened, I'm pretty sure, because it was the morning afterwards that I noticed it. It was the first time that I saw these orange orbs, when there was this cloud that floated over and literally melted away. And there was this triangle formation of 25, 30 orange orbs just in a triangle. And they flew over my head. And the next day I woke up, I went in the shower, I was drying myself off, and I looked down and just immediately saw these three red dots in an equilateral triangle. And, you know, there's no scabbing, there was no bump, it just looked like scarred skin, like the skin had been lifted up and it had scarred over, but there was no pain or anything. And they are a little faded now, because obviously dead skin flakes are starting to, you know, it happens over time, but I can still see them, and I could take a photo. You wouldn't be able to see it on here, definitely not, but I don't know if they took me. Maybe they did. Some people tell me, oh, you definitely got taken, you know, you've got these marks on your arm. I try and think of it in different ways, and maybe there's another explanation for it. It does seem like it might actually be connected to that event. But, you know, it did make me think, well, maybe I was taken. And if I was, that's against my will. I didn't want that. I didn't want to be abducted and experimented on. And so I can't say for sure what I know CE5 is, but I'm pretty confident that CE5 is you getting to a certain frequency that other beings are already at. And once you reach that frequency, they can pick up on it. They're aware of it. And, you know, we've seen this as evidence from the UFO phenomena alone. They seem to be able to subvert time and space. So it distance, you know, people think, oh, are you just phoning them up and they're drifting around in a star system, and then they kick in their engines and they start flying? No, I don't think it is that. I think it's something stranger, more metaphysical, and obviously has nothing to do with time or distance, you know?
Well, I think metaphysical is for me is absolutely sort of where it's at. And you know, as you're talking there, I'm reminded of when you talk about, and I think in an interview you did video, you talked about this black cloud being kind of staticky, and it reminds me very much of something actually that happened at Skimmer. I'm just conscious of the fact we might have frozen here. Have we frozen?
I'm okay. We're having a couple of moments, but it seems to be okay. Yeah, I can hear you.
Are we back in the room?
Yeah.
It just while you were talking about that cloud, that static cloud experience, it reminded me of an account that I'd read, funny enough, at Skinwalker, but not during the current tenure, but before, when Bigelow owned it. And I know a few of the scientists who investigated the phenomena there, and one of them describes a black cloud, and had an altogether less satisfactory experience as a result of it than you did. But I think that that thing that you're talking about the attitude or the intention with which you go to meet the phenomena in this non-literal realm is possibly key. And, you know, in a sense, you get back out of it what you put into it.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Not saying that, by the way, that, you know, NIDS researchers went into Skinwalker with a bad attitude. I'm just saying that they went into it with a mind to research the hell out of it.
Yeah.
And actually got, you know, some sort of quite scary things came back at them. So who knows, you know. But I do agree with you. I think it possibly is a resonant phenomenon, and the resonance with which you, or the frequency with which you go into that experience may dictate what you get back out of it.
Absolutely. You know, some people have, because obviously I speak to a lot of different people in the community, and especially people that have had, you know, consciousness contact or continue to have that type of contact. You know, I've asked a lot of people what they think it is. Some people even think that it could be almost echoing back to what we said about the overmind or the collective unconscious, that it's almost like a flashbulb of your own consciousness responding back to you. And, you know, maybe that's the case. But I do think that there is some element of there is a separate entity there. You know, I believe ultimately we are one. We are this one conscious energy that's representing itself in all these different forms. So within that model, there are all these different forms. So that is a different form. I don't think it's just me creating a flash in the sky. And the reason I think that is because I have actually sat in my room and, like, you know, had the same sorts of thoughts and played out, and nothing's flashed in my room, and haven't had an orb suddenly, you know, appear in the sky, it floating above my TV or anything like that. So I do think that this is something that's coming and visiting, and especially with these orbs. And I've tried to understand these more and more, and I can't, because, you know, the first experience, obviously, they came over in this triangle formation, very tight, like a military formation almost, you know, and makes you think of almost a squadron of flying orbs, not so much ethereal or, you know, spiritual. It seemed more like a technology for some reason at that point. But the closest interaction I had was when three of them actually floated down and were literally above the ceiling I'm pointing at right now. I was outside in my garden and they were floating above the roof of my house, three of them. And they're these roughly football, maybe slightly larger sized orange, pastel colored orange and slightly translucent orbs. And they were literally about that far above my roof, and there was no glow. There was no glow onto the roof. This light was completely self-contained. It was not giving off a coronal discharge. It wasn't giving off any sort of dissipation onto the local environment. So this is a completely novel type of photon physics that you're seeing happen here. And that's why some people said, well, maybe they're projecting from your consciousness, and it's like a conscious light image that doesn't have to interact in the same way as a light bulb does, because it's not the same type of light. And I don't know, but these things, they're so beyond the scope of my understanding that I'm infinitely curious. I haven't had my answers given to me. I've got more questions now than I really, you know, had at the beginning. But it feels like they activated something in me, you know, whether or not literally or just as as an expression. I now can't not do what I'm doing. Like it would be completely insane to me to stop doing Project Unity. You know, there have been bad things that have come from this. You know, I've had family members who think I'm completely insane, you know, and it's just one of those things where I've had lots of issues from it, because I've had to explain myself to people that I never thought I'd have to, because, you know, I'm a smart guy and people know me and talk to me. But then I suddenly had this experience and I changed my way of thinking. So it's, you know, it's just one of those things where I feel like I probably won't ever find the answer to those experiences, but it feels like they happened so that I could start doing what I'm doing now. So I don't see it as a negative, but I do believe in the law of attraction. So if you're going out with a negative mindset, then perhaps it's not advisable to be doing a CE5.
Well, I agree completely about the mindset thing. And it's all I've ever wanted to do when I've approached this subject is to approach it positively. And so I'm totally with you on that. I mean, interestingly, while you're speaking about it, I'm reminded that that sort of paradoxical quality about something that seems ostensibly very real. So your description of the orbs and, you know, how they are there above the house, but yet they don't, you know, they give off a strange light that doesn't reflect. I mean, that in a sense is carried over into other realms, such as the energy realm, you know, which I looked at into for a while. And you get very interesting, strange, and paradoxical descriptions by the inventors of, you know, electricity that runs cold. That runs cold. Yeah. Doesn't make sense, but yet there seems to be something in it. So all the time we have this strange, you know, I mean, it's well documented by, you know, Jacques Vallée and others, this high strangeness aspect of the phenomenon or the phenomena. And endlessly fascinating to me. And as you say, we'll, you know, it doesn't seem right that we should ever get to an explanation or the bottom of what consciousness is, because that truly would be the end of the mystery. Yeah. But I get the sense, of course, that, you know, you're on a pathway to find out. You want to know as much about it as possible.
Yeah.
And so do I. To me, consciousness is just this endlessly fascinating realm that throws up all these weird and wonderful phenomena. And I think we're sort of living in a period when we just happen to be getting thrown quite a lot of them.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're in a very interesting time period, and I'm personally, as a young individual, even though there's a lot going on, I'm actually excited and optimistic for the future. Now, Nick, I know you got to go pretty soon, so we'll finish this up here. It's been a brilliant conversation. One thing I wanted to ask you just before we finish this off: would you ever consider doing that type of thing, going out and attempting to make contact, sit in your back garden and look up at the stars and send some thoughts off?
Well, I'm a great stargazer anyway, and I go out into the garden, I gaze at the night sky, and I just go satellite watching. You know, I mean, that's a relatively recent experience for me. So, of course, I've always wanted to see a UFO. I've never seen a UFO. I've hung out, you know, I've seen some pretty strange stuff when I've hung out near Area 51. But I'm pretty sure I've been able to put a terrestrial explanation onto most of the stuff that I've seen flying around Area 51. I'd try anything. Particularly when it pertains to consciousness and that, you know, experience of wanting to plumb its depths and secrets and mysteries a little more than I have. So basically, yeah, I'm up for anything.
Well, maybe we should hang out sometime. You might be able to see something, Nick.
I think that's a very good idea. I would love to join you and do a bit of stargazing.
Brilliant. All right. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the channel. Hopefully we'll have you back sometime, and enjoy the rest of your evening, mate.
Great. Thank you, Jay. And thanks for entertaining some of my questions as well.